Hello and welcome to Economics in 10 with Gav and Pete, or Pete and Gav. Yes, this is a special podcast where we're looking at the economics of happiness, or how economics can save your life. But we'll still be asking 10 questions that will hopefully inform you and get you thinking about how economics can improve your well-being. So, first question of our first special. Yeah. What concept are we looking at first? And does it relate to the fact that everybody says, how come your podcasts aren't 10 minutes? is it related to that?
Well, so today we're going to look at various economic theories. We've had something to say or other that we think might shed light on how you can improve your quality of your well-being. Let's start with some really basic economics. The law of diminishing marginal utility.
Yep.
Have you come across that, Gav?
Yes, one of the first things we teach. It's very exciting.
Yes, it is. And so it's a very simple concept. And basically it relates to how if you consume one unit, it might give you a great deal of pleasure. And you say unit, let's bring it to life.
Yeah.
Let's talk about cream buns.
Love it. Yeah?
You have a cream bun? Does that give you pleasure?
Yeah, I do like a cream bun.
Yeah? And so in economics, we call pleasure utility.
Yeah, I always found that odd.
Yeah. So first cream bun.
Do you know why that is, by the way?
What?
Why is it called utility?
I don't know.
It's a strange expression, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it probably... Maybe it's one of those words that was more in usage in the 19th century when people were developing this idea.
Anyway.
So there we are. So first cream bun gives you a great deal of pleasure. Second cream bun.
Still probably would give me a lot of pleasure.
A lot of pleasure. As much as the first?
I like cream buns. Depends on how hungry I was. So, second one, maybe.
What about, all right.
Third one, no.
No.
Fourth one, ugh.
Fifth one,
ugh.
So, what you've just described so viscerally is the law of diminishing marginal utility. So, I guess, very simple concept. Don't eat too many cream buns. Or just recognise... in consumption of any unit, or perhaps any sort of pursuit, sometimes less is more.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an important economic concept, actually. It underlines lots of other things like demand curves, which perhaps we'll come to in future podcasts. Interestingly, Adam Smith talked about utility. He talked about the paradox of water and diamonds. Have you come across that?
Yes, this is the thing about how, obviously, diamonds are pretty much useless.
Yes.
And yet, they're worth so much, or with the price we put on them.
Yeah.
Because we infrequently use it.
Yeah.
Or consume it.
Yeah, it's water we consume a lot of.
And so that we have no value on it.
Yeah. But imagine how much you would pay for your first glass of water after crossing a desert.
Yeah.
There's a kind of war film loosely based on that premise. What's that about water? Ice Cold in Alex.
Yeah, okay. Is that what it's about, is it?
Yeah, kind of. It's about this group who are crossing the desert to... you know, it's connected with the desert campaign in World War II. Well, I think one of them promises the other an ice cold beer in Alexandria when they get there.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, and at the end, they do have an ice cold beer in Alexandria.
All right.
It reminds me of a time I went on a 24-hour coach journey to the south of France that had no air conditioning. By the time we got there, it was tough. When we got out, I remember buying one of these enormous sort of litre beers and just sort of draining it pretty much in one.
Yeah.
And before the listeners get any sense that I'm a big drinker, I'm not, I'm a lightweight. It was just very necessary. So that is the law of diminishing marginal utility.
Yeah. So we take away from that, first of all, our little thing about in terms of how you can improve your happiness.
Yeah.
Basically, don't overconsume.
Don't overconsume. Yeah. There might be exceptions.
Everything in moderation.
Everything in moderation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Gav.
Okay.
And are you going to ping our bell?
Yeah, I will. Yeah. So, what do you know about the Easterlin paradox?
Okay. The Easterlin paradox was developed by an economist called Easterlin, funnily enough. Richard Easterlin. Richard Easterlin. He actually wrote this in the 1970s. Right. I didn't realise. I thought it was more modern than that because it's kind of come back very much in vogue. And the Easterlin paradox is basically an observation based on people's self-reported satisfaction that despite vast increases in incomes and wealth in the sort of post-war era, we don't seem to be getting any happier as societies in the West.
Yeah.
Now, it's a bit subtler than that. So basically what he notices is that within a society, rich people tend to be happier than poor people. But rich societies tend to be no more happy than poor societies, or not by very much.
Right.
So in other words, you would expect like the US, the UK to have considerably higher levels of reported satisfaction than perhaps with, you know, Kenya or Bangladesh, somewhere like that. And as countries get even richer, they don't get any happier.
It's like a diminishing returns to money.
Almost. Well, perhaps even take money away, just sort of more stuff doesn't seem to make us happier. Although our position in society does.
Right.
So in a sense, if you're richer than someone else in the same society, that does seem to give you a certain amount of satisfaction. Yeah. So I've got a little scenario for you.
Right.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah, go on for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want you to imagine that I can get 5,000. No, you can get 5,000, and a friend, say me, gets 3,000.
Yeah.
That's scenario number one. You happy with that?
Yeah, I'm quite happy with that.
You get 5,000, I only get 3. Yeah. Okay. In the second one, you get 10,000, but I get 15.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be maybe slightly unhappy. Yeah. It's the comparison thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we have that all the time. I mean, you think about school, you know, with some students, even though they get good grades, they just compare it to their friends.
Yeah.
And it's madness sometimes. Yeah. They've just sometimes got to look at the bigger picture and think, what do they do for themselves? Yeah. What's good for them?
Just going back to our scenario, I'd have been happy for you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're not extended that to me. Yeah. I felt like friendship overall.
Well, I'm delighted you got 15 grand. You know,
and you've got 10, you know.
Yeah, I've got 10. It's a fair point.
Today we are. So why do we have the Eastland paradox? There's various theories about this. So, for example, Eastland himself talked about what he called hedonic adaptation.
Like it.
Which is almost like you grow into your extra salary. He must have found this. You know, I was looking through old paperwork the other day. I found one of my first ever pay slips. And you look at it now and it's probably a fraction of what I earn now. And yet, would I be any happier now with my sort of standard of living than I was then?
Yeah.
Maybe a bit, but not that much. In other words, your expectations keep a pace with your the growth in your wealth or salary. And so that's one explanation. Right. So Eastland's basically just said, well, as we get more money, our aspirations increase.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair enough. And it becomes more expensive.
And the other sort of proposition put forward is actually more to do with another economist, Richard Layard. Heard of him?
Yes.
Yes, yeah, quite a famous economist, or he's become famous in recent years. And he talks about more, but during that period, that post-war era, he talks about the other changes that have occurred to society in that time as well. So like social fragmentation, divorce rates, insecure work.
Okay.
So maybe that correlation is due to those other changes, if you like. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I assume it relates a little bit to, as well, maybe not, in terms of, again, how you kind of, what you're attending to. I mean, we're going to probably talk about this maybe a bit later.
Maybe
I'm not too sure.
Yeah.
But this idea that when you see your salary's gone up, you look at it and you go, ooh.
Yeah,
brilliant.
So initially, you pay attention to that.
But then after a while, you just don't pay attention to it, so you don't notice it, and then your life's getting on, and that's it.
You're over it.
Yeah. Unless you continually keep on looking at that pay rise, which would be a complete waste of time.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It is, and there's a, was it, who coined the term status anxiety? De Botton?
Ooh.
Alain de Botton?
Lovely pronunciation. I'm not sure.
I think he wrote a book on it, Status Anxiety, and I think people, you know, I think have been classified as having that as a medical kind of condition.
Come on.
Of having status. Yeah, like status anxiety. Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it?
So, what can we take away from Eastland's ideas? What can help the listeners?
Well, don't get hooked up too much on the bling bling. No, I mean, obviously, we do have to understand that there is a base, isn't there?
Yeah.
A base. So money is important to a point.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then we've got to find other enrichment activities.
Yeah.
Which we'll probably go on to
looking yeah, at. Yeah, no, we will. We will yeah. when we talk about happiness and what might be connected with it. Mm. So.
Yeah, we're happy with that.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That's the Easterlin paradox. Very good evaluative point for A-level economists out there. So, we're currently in the middle of an obesity epidemic. I don't know if you've realised.
Yes.
Excellent. And I hear that governments are trying to nudge people to being healthier. What does that mean?
What does it mean? So the idea of nudge, by the way, was, or nudging people, it was popularised by a pair of economists called Thaler. Do you say Thaler or Thaler?
Mm. Richard Thaler.
And Sunstein. Yeah?
Yeah.
Or Sunstein.
Cass.
Cass.
Yeah.
Cass.
Sunstein. Sunstein.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
So they wrote a book called Nudge. And the idea of nudge is it's trying to look at how sort of small changes in what they call choice architecture. So in other words, the context in which you operate can lead to changes in people's behaviour. It's probably best explained with a few examples. So one example mentioned in the book relates to men's toilets.
Yeah, this okay. is the classic, isn't it?
Now, if we have female listeners out there, and I'm hoping we do.
Yeah.
If you've ever been in a gents' toilets, I hope you haven't. Because they're horrible.
Yeah, not nice.
They stink, and there's often wee on the floor.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant. Maybe female toilets are the same. I don't know, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
They're particularly gross. If you ever go into a large sporting fixture, like a sort of big football ground, or even a little football ground.
Yeah, pretty gross.
The toilets are awful. Mm. And but men kind of revel in it as well, don't
yeah.
they? Like, hey, we're wading in it.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah.
yeah.
So.
The worst days for them is when, because normally when you're having, I don't want to go down this route really, it's
yeah.
disgusting, but normally you're just wearing normal shoes, aren't you? Trousers,
yeah.
etc.
Yeah, yeah.
The worst is when you're going to summer for the first time, you're wearing flip-flops.
Ooh.
And you just feel that little bit of spray on your
oh,
feet.
Oh, no.
No, and it's grim, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's when you realise for the first time, yeah. genuinely, for the whole of the year, you are basically having wee sprayed on your feet.
Yeah, which is unpleasant. So, the observation I was going to make is, I can't remember who did this, actually, but
It was an airport, wasn't it?
But basically what they did was they put into the ceramic of the urinal, there was an image of a fly. So basically it gave men something to aim at.
Mm.
And apparently this had a marked effect on the amount of urine on the floor.
Mm.
Yeah. So in other words, it's just a little nudge, a little tiny thing that has changed behaviour somewhat.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, businesses have been aware of this idea of nudge for years. I mean, if you've got kids and you ever get to a till, and you'll suddenly notice that by the till are lots of sort of chocolates, things that the kids might like. And just as you're about to pay, there they are, your captive audience for your child who wants some chocolate.
Yeah.
So businesses are very aware of this. And really, governments are increasingly aware of this and trying to use little nudges to perhaps change people's behaviour in a sort of paternalistic manner. So we mentioned the fly in the urinal is a sort of more positive idea. Apparently in a grocery store, the change to choice architecture was something about follow this green arrow for health.
Yeah.
And it directs you towards more healthy foodstuffs. So they talk about this choice architecture creating conditions in which you're more likely to make good choices. There's a few little acronyms they use in this, so EAST. You've come across EAST?
Yep.
So do you want to explain that? Can you remember what
no,
EAST stands
I can't
for?
It's easy is the E.
Yeah, so it's basically making choices easy, attractive, social, and timely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if you want to create a nudge, you need to sort of create a choice architecture, a context in which doing the right thing is easy, attractive, social, and timely. Yeah, we want things to be easy. So let's give an example of that. If I get put on a bit of weight, want to do a bit more running, how can I apply EAST?
Yeah.
So to make it easy, I might sort of leave my kit out, ready to go run. It's a lovely kit. It's nice and attractive.
Yeah, like it.
I might choose a nice place to go for a run, so it's attractive again. And to make it social, I might do it with a friend. I'm more likely to do it if it's with a friend and I've agreed to do it. There's a sort of normative push there to do it. And timely, I might arrange to do it maybe, you know, on my way home or something. Something that is a good time to do it that sort of links well with my particular lifestyle. You ever done Park Run, Gav?
No, I've signed up to it.
I think Park Run links to this. You know, it's easy to do Park Run. Yeah. So it's got that. It's attractive. You're like part of a group. And obviously the social aspect to it.
Yeah.
And it is timely. I always think Saturday mornings, it kind of starts off the weekend proper, but you've got the rest of the game.
Yeah.
So I suppose you could see that as East in action. Do you know how Park Run started, by the way?
No.
Yeah. Listening to another good podcast, you know, Ed Miliband.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't an enormous fan of when he was Labour leader.
Yeah.
Great podcast, Reasons to be Cheerful, which he does with Jeff Lloyd. But they interviewed, kind of the CEO of Park Run, but apparently started by a guy who was sort of down on his luck. He just got divorced. I think he was drinking a bit too much and then decided he didn't want to. And he really liked running, but then he got injured. He persuaded his friends to come down to the local park, and he timed them, you know, while he was injured. So it just started off with 13 people initially.
Mm.
And then they'd all go for a coffee afterwards, which fits in quite nicely with the social aspect of that East typology. Yeah. So governments have focused on this, and there's a nudge unit.
Yes.
Now, do you remember David Cameron?
Yes. Yes. And his trotters up somewhere in Nice. Yeah. Or in his shed somewhere.
Even before David Cameron, actually, I think there was a nudge unit installed. The Behavioural Insights team was installed at the heart of government. And they looked to find little nudges that would make government more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So even like with like tax returns, they'd look at the wording of letters. So it would be 95% of people pay their taxes on time.
Yeah,
and it would play on that sort of social aspect almost of, you know, you don't want to be like the people who don't, the 5%.
Yeah.
So they had that behavioural insights team.
Although this podcast is about happiness, and I'm sure paying your taxes. We're reminding people about paying their taxes, aren't we, there?
You don't think that makes people happy?
Well, the example you just showed there, I mean, I'm just saying. Well,
what about the running? The running was all right.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose what could you... The government has focused on sort of well-being, haven't they? And the people have increasingly tried to put together that... even the plastic tax. You know, they say plastic tax. Paying 10p for... sort of plastic bags. That's had a massive... It's only a small little nudge, if you like, but it's had a massive impact on people's behaviour. You know, they do take plastic bags. You know, you'll see people sometimes at our local co-op carrying out masses of stuff.
Yeah.
Like in their arms, you know. It's going to drop down a minute. They don't want to buy
a bag. It's quite fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
Seeing people juggle their shopping these days.
Yeah.
Mm.
So in terms of our takeaway from that, I suppose...
Well, just quickly, I want to carry on to that because...
Apologies.
The whole thing is, I suppose, even though we're nudging people, say, to be healthier, which hopefully will make them happier and stuff like that, the idea of the social side is kind of fascinating, I think.
Mm.
Because, again, even though it sounds quite brutal in Paul Dolan's book... you know, kind of related to happiness.
He's, happiness by design, that's what you're talking about, by Paul Dolan.
Yeah. And he says, in terms of the social side of things, you've got to, if you're going to be happy, you kind of want to be spending time with your friends who are happy.
Yeah.
Aren't they? There's that. I know you weren't as happy about that, but I think that idea of the social side of things, I think it can be quite important because there's something that we talk about a lot in... sometimes in teaching, which I wasn't, you know, a great fan of, but radiators and drains, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, this idea of, like, surround yourself with radiators, people who lift you up. And I think kind of Paul Dolan says that. It nudges you to be happier. I want to read a poem.
Oh.
Hope you don't mind.
You've gone early.
Yeah, it's not mine.
Right, okay.
But I was told this by my friend Ricardo.
Go for it.
The other day, and I think it's a great one because it's about social and being happy. And it's by Spike Milligan. And I'm sure many people have heard it, but if they haven't, it's a lovely poem. It's called Smile. Smiling is infectious. You catch it like the flu. When someone smiled at me today, I started smiling too. I walked around the corner and someone saw me grin. When he smiled, I realised I'd passed it on to him and thought about the smile and then realised its worth a single smile like mine could travel around the earth. So if you feel a smile begin, don't leave it undetected. Start an epidemic and get the world infected.
Oh, I love that.
It's a lovely poem, isn't it?
Apparently, you know, psychologically, if you do smile, it actually it changes your mood.
Yes. Now, yeah. I wrote that down somewhere because people can do this at home. Yeah. stick a pencil between your teeth.
Right.
And Richard Wiseman says that just that act of forcing you to smile will basically make you happier.
Does sticking a pencil between your teeth make you smile?
Yeah, no, yeah, that you have to through your teeth. I mean, you can't really see that, but but if you put it front ways between your lips and you're pouting,
right,
you're more miserable. Apparently, it was done in two tests, something by Laird in 1974, and was it Stratch et al. Or something in 1988, and they did this experiment basically looking at kind of happy pictures, and it made you happier if you had already stuck that thing in. I like that idea of, you know, feeling happy then makes you happy, or like the physical act of being happy.
What's that phrase? Act it before you feel it. What is it?
Yeah, that'll do.
Oh. It's snappier than that.
But also, I want another thing related to Paul Dolan's book, because I did find it mildly fascinating, is that sometimes what gives you happiness is getting stuff done.
Yeah,
like having a purpose and getting stuff done. And people think that multitasking is a way to get lots of things done. Now, in Caroline Webb's book, How to Have a Good Day, there's a really excellent exercise that I want you to do, Pete.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
What now? Exciting.
Yeah. It's to do with multitasking and then single tasking. Okay. So she says, basically, multitasking, bit of a waste of time.
Right.
What you want to do is focus. It's all about focus on your single task. So what are you going to do? I want you to think about A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H.
Yeah.
Right. And then 1 to 8. Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4. And what I want you to do is, and I'm going to time you.
Yeah.
You're going to say A1, B2, C3 as quickly as you can.
Yeah.
Okay. Up until H8.
Okay.
Okay. Ready and go.
A1, B2, C3, D4, E5, F6, G7, H8.
Right. Okay. That took you 7 seconds.
Right.
Now, all I want you to do is quite simply do A to H and then 1, 2, you know, all the way through. So, again, splitting the task down now. So you're going to go A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Pretty simple.
Yeah.
And go.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
4 seconds. Ooh. Now, she uses that as a really simplistic way of showing how just single tasking, focusing on something quite, you know, it's quicker than multitasking.
Yeah, interesting.
And I quite like that as an example. I sometimes use that at school with students.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
So, in terms of that section, what did we start off talking about? Nudges, didn't we?
Yes.
So, I guess what we need to... What's our takeaway from that? Oh, we've had smiling. Smile a bit more.
Yeah, smile. You know, spread the joy.
Yeah.
You know.
But maybe also thinking if you want to change something, either in yourself or perhaps in others, like if you work in an organisation, let's say you want to reduce environmental waste or something like that, think about the choice architecture. Try and make things easy, attractive,
For people
social
to do.
And timely. You know, if you want to change your behaviour, consider that typography.
Yeah. I think, are we happy with that?
I'm happy.
Yeah, good. Okay. Now, many of our students in the future will probably be struggling to buy a house. Yeah. So you can get pretty miserable about it. And then you kind of rack up a debt because of, you know, studying at university potentially. Yeah. So that can make you unhappy.
Yeah.
Tell me why they shouldn't worry about it.
Well, okay, one of our economists who pops up seemingly in every podcast we've done is a chap called Milton Friedman.
Yeah.
And one of Friedman's main pieces of economic theory is the permanent lifetime income hypothesis. Or is it lifetime income hypothesis? But anyway, it's a very simple concept, and it's basically normally when we assume, like, why do people spend what they spend? So we assume it's based to their current income. So you might think, right, this person earns this much, they're going to spend this much. But what Friedman said was, well, actually, our spending is not as closely correlated with our income as you might think. And we tend to have a sense of our lifetime income when we're engaged in current spending. Now, in a roundabout way, what that means is you might well run up a lot of debt when you're young, either going to university or buying a house, but you will end up paying that up or paying that off as you get older.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you might feel poor when you're young, but hopefully your incomes will improve and your spending will not be smooth over the course of your lifetime. And it's an observation by Friedman, but it's probably quite an apt one. Yeah, and
so just don't worry about it.
Yeah, don't worry about it. The only thing, oh no, I was going to sort of rain on the parade here.
Oh, go on then.
We are getting a lot older, aren't we? You know, and which is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, life expectancy has improved dramatically. And you do wonder whether that's a bit of a challenge to sort of Friedman's, you know, will we have, I don't know, do we need to save even more when we're younger if we're going to enjoy a sort of healthy retirement?
Maybe. Or... I mean, if people are that concerned, I mean, living longer, if you want...
It's a good thing, though, isn't it?
If you want to buy a house, you can probably now stretch it over 40-odd years. But apparently there is data that suggests that... it says home ownership is pretty weakly associated to happiness.
Yeah.
So there you go. So
very much a British thing, though, isn't it, home ownership?
Yeah.
If you look at Germany, which is probably arguably a more successful economy than the UK, loads of people rent, even quite wealthy people. It's like the British, an Englishman's home is his castle.
Yeah.
It's quite a British thing. Yeah.
Again, let's try not to worry about it.
Yeah, let's try not to worry about it. So our takeaway from that one is...
I think it's your classic one sometimes with students. I'm going to go back to students here.
Yeah.
Is that some people get anxious, don't they, at what's going to be happening tomorrow and so on. And sometimes I say to them, take a kind of a helicopter view.
Yeah, a longer
just
view.
Pull out.
Yeah.
And have a look at it and think, actually,
things
will be okay.
Play the long game.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think that's it.
It's pretty much what Friedman said, isn't it?
Yeah. I would argue. Every time I turn on the news, Pete, there's doom and gloom about the state of the world, So what work from an economist can I look at and think, hey, life's not so bad?
Well, I'm not sure, strictly speaking, he's an economist, but there is a statistician. I think he may be actually a doctor originally by training. And unfortunately, he's passed away now.
Yeah.
But a guy called Hans Rosling. Now, I'd thoroughly recommend watching his TED Talks on YouTube. Some TED Talks are great, some aren't, but I think his are brilliant.
Yeah, they're good.
And what they really bring to life is the idea that, you know, life might not be perfect, but it is infinitely better for many, many people than it has been in the past. And it breaks down that, you know, in different areas. And because I think we get a sense, because we watch the news it's not good news typically. It's sort of negative things which are happening today or yesterday and so on. And again, we lose that longer view picture of the huge strides we've made in so many areas of life. If you take life expectancy, for example, it's increased dramatically just in the last 50 years. And basically, the book he's written, which is associated with the talks I mentioned, is called Factfulness. And it's very simply just bringing us back to the facts. What's happened to poverty? What's happened to life expectancy and so on? And you know, you come back to the idea that things aren't perfect. We might want to improve them, but they are better. And actually, sometimes I think if we don't recognise that, it makes us feel a bit disenfranchised, a bit pessimistic about the future. And whereas, you know, we should realise that humanity can improve itself and has done in really quite significant ways in lots of different areas.
Yeah.
And we tend to get bogged down in the day-to-day, and perhaps we need to take, again, that longer view. And it's not about being complacent. There are things in the world we want to change, but we need to recognise that people in the past have done things which have changed, you know, the humanity's progress in quite a significant way, successfully, and therefore we can too.
Yeah, and in that book, or on his talks normally, he kind of asks key questions, doesn't he? You know, like what percentage of people are, you know, in primary school or whatever.
Yeah.
And he always refers to it that the audiences on the whole are living in a, you know, a 20-year ago mindset.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's so important to kind of get up with that. His son, Max Rosling now, isn't it? I think has basically taken over the reins. And you can go, there's a great site, it's called Gapminder, I think it is.
Yeah.
.org, where you can look at lots of different stats that are so positive. That Factfulness book really lifts you, doesn't it?
But not just positive as well. We do get this idea that there is us in the West who are wealthy and our lifestyles are good. And then there's this other group of poor people around the world. And what it does on that website, I can't remember the name, but it's something Street.
Dollar Street.
Dollar Street, yeah, that's it.
Good.
And it looks at people in different countries on different income levels. And really, it shows you pictures of their lifestyles. So you really get a sense of what poverty looks like, but also how even within countries, like a country like we might see as a poor country, there are people with good lifestyles there. But it also brings to life the people who don't have good lifestyles. So you're just really clear about what life is like in different countries, rather than all these assumptions we make about, oh, we've got it good, they've got it bad. Yeah. And it breaks it down into different levels as well, rather than just sort of, you know, there isn't this sort of camp of us wealthy, them poor, but different gradations of income. So it really shows you in quite a lot of detail what those different gradations look like and what that means for how people live on a day-to-day basis. So I'd really recommend that. It's Dollar Street, isn't it?
The
website's called Gapminder.
Yeah, and it's like level 1, 2, 3, 4.
That's right.
And we think that level like 2 might be awful, but in actual fact, the difference between level 1 to level 2 for some people is a massive increase in their kind of income level, or happiness, as it were, or the things that they have.
Yeah.
So it's a great positive book, Factfulness, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not kind of some sort of taking you off to la la land, everything's perfect.
Yeah.
It's not that. It's just bringing you back to the facts. You know, the facts are that humanity has improved, you know, people's lives across a range of different metrics. Yeah,
like it. Okay, that's a top recommendation to read. I'm currently booking my summer holidays, but tell me, why might I want to go to Bhutan as an economist?
Okay.
Did I say Bhutan?
No, you did. I'm not laughing at that. I'm just laughing at your leading.
Okay.
Okay. So Bhutan is associated with an innovation in how sort of national sort of performance should be measured. So obviously, we've talked about this in previous episodes. GDP, gross domestic product, is the main way in which we make comparisons between different countries. This country's got GDP growth at this level. It's got GDP per capita, GDP per head of this level. And we make comparisons along those lines. But taking us back to like the Easterlin sort of paradox, and also the work of people like Layard, are we getting any happier? And ultimately, what's the purpose of economics? Surely it should be about making us happier.
Yeah.
If it's not, well, what is the point? But we don't actually measure sort of happiness or people, you know, do people with all these sort of improvements in economic growth, do they feel any happier? So Bhutan is the country where they started to measure not just gross domestic product, but gross national happiness.
Yep.
And I think I sort of looked at the reference for this, and there was an interview with a British journalist and the King of Bhutan at the time in 1972. And he said gross national happiness is more important than gross national product.
Yeah.
So really, there's been an increase in recent years in countries trying to measure people's sort of subjective levels of well-being. Yeah. And really, shouldn't we make that the focus? Rather than this sort of endless pursuit of growth, shouldn't we be focusing on trying to improve people's happiness and looking at what makes people happy, and then maybe sort of creating the conditions in which those things are likely to thrive. And this brings us back to, before we do that, it's a great speech critiquing GDP by Bobby Kennedy.
Brilliant. Fantastic.
It's a really good speech. Yeah. I mean, you can see transcripts of it on the internet, but you can also see him speaking.
Yeah.
It's quite poignant, really, because it's about a year before
he was assassinated. But I'll just read you a very brief bit of it.
Yep.
But the full speech is well worth reading. But he says, GDP measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile.
Yeah, it's a really good one.
It's a really good one. It talks in the longer speech about the things that are included in GDP. You know, like you would include the cost of cleaning up pollution, I think. Or,
yeah, like bulletproof windows. Yeah. I mean, and stuff like that. I find quite odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know.
And just to give it a bit of a UK context, back before, you know, old David Cameron retreated to his garden shed, he was interested in happiness economics, and it's still measured in the Office for National Statistics.
Yeah.
It's not, yeah, it's just, we're not really talking about happiness at
well,
a national macroeconomic level at the moment. But
the thing is that happiness over the last year has gone down by something like 5%.
Yeah.
Now, I was wondering about this because, again, going back to Paul Dolan's book, he says about one of the things is quite fascinating about happiness or well-being. It's this idea about uncertainty.
Yeah.
You know, and so even though it might seem kind of quite odd, even if it's bad, as long as you know, like, with certainty something's bad, or if it's certainty, for, you know, he talks about kind of cancer and things like that.
Yeah.
It's when you're in limbo
that
you're kind of in your most unhappiness. And I just think, again, we mention Brexit every episode, but
we try not to.
Yeah.
Just
but that. I wonder whether the uncertainty, I mean, whether you think it's a good idea or a bad idea, it's a discussion for another day. But, you know, if we've made a mind up, we get out or we stay in, and you know, the government says, right, we've listened to it, but we're going to stay in, boom, straight like that. We've made a choice. Whatever the choice is going to be, good or bad, depending on how you view it, it's the uncertainty of everything. It's just making everybody miserable.
Yeah.
Everybody miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. We're trying to make people happy in this.
Yeah, it's a fair point.
I've got a few questions for you.
Excellent, okay. Love it.
So, which area of the UK has the highest self-reported level of happiness?
Which area?
Yes. I think it'll surprise you.
I'm going to go something like Dorset.
No. Northern Ireland.
Really?
Yeah. It's interesting. I was reading that, and apparently there's some speculation. It's because there is a very strong sense of community there.
Yeah.
So you might be in one of two camps, but you definitely feel part of a community.
Yeah,
and lots of the studies about happiness talk about that. Even when we talk about, you know, Layard's view on why we have this Eastland paradox, he talks about perhaps it's due to a sort of decline in people being part of communities.
Yeah,
that's why I love Parkrun as well. You know, you just think, again, you see social enterprises which are bringing people together.
I think that's the thing about, you know, fractured community, or just generally the world of work, isn't it, that we're all kind of being driven to drive more, and we spend all this time commuting, and if you can, if possible, spend more time with people.
I read a little bit about commuting, actually.
Yeah.
Which book was that in? I can't remember, I've lost track. But commuting, someone did a study, and it looked at, you know, commuting basically makes people miserable, and it's quite a strong link between shorter commutes and subjective reports of happiness.
Right.
But they were saying in the study, it's trying to encourage people to talk to commuters.
Mm.
Now, we obviously live near London, and the idea of
pretty difficult
talking on the tube to someone you don't know, they would edge away from you.
Yeah, you'd be seen as odd.
Short of sort of, you know, pulling out an eye for something, you don't want to talk to people on the tube.
Yeah.
But apparently it helps. You know, people who sort of started up conversations on train, even with strangers, then, you know, reported higher levels of happiness.
Oh, do you know what? When I was out yesterday in St. Albans shopping, I tried to, I did that. I was feeling quite positive. And every person I spoke to at all, said, how's your day?
Yeah.
You know, and they embraced it, and then you kind of walk off. Yeah. It's a bit like the Spike Milligan thing again.
Yeah,
it's about just passing on happiness. Just passing on happiness.
I mean, as you know, I am a man of the North originally, and I must say, this is one thing you do notice when you go back to the North, is that shopkeepers and so on will talk to you and engage in conversation, and I think it does make everyone happier.
Yeah, unless you're in Lidl or Aldi.
Why?
Because they just bomb through the stuff. They haven't got time to talk. Boom. It's £4.50.
I quite like the shopkeepers in my local.
Speed is incredible.
Okay, so I think there's a little mini takeaway from that, isn't there? Maybe trying to sort of talk to people a little bit more if you're sort of engaged in a sort of dull situation.
But from a wider level, GDP, maybe we should be looking...
There's more anyway. I'm coming back. That's a little mini takeaway within a
takeaway. Okay, yeah. Good.
I've got more questions for you.
Okay, yeah.
Which profession has the highest level of self-reported happiness?
Well, I think I found that out.
Okay.
And I've got, it was a marketing manager.
No.
But maybe it wasn't. plumber.
No.
Okay, go on, what was it?
Obviously looking at different studies. I've got the clergy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I had down here from a boundless happiness index, very happy in work, the top were property developers, and then electricians, and the unhappiest were advertising and social workers.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I got as the unhappiest, I was going to come to that, publicans, people running a pub.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be pretty tasty in it sometimes. Yeah.
Well, I got my data from David Halpern's Inside the Nudge Unit.
Oh, right. Well, that's probably much...
Yeah. Well, who knows? Now, I've got another question for you.
Yeah.
And this relates again to something from in that book, Inside the Nudge Unit, which I quite liked.
Good book, that.
So someone called Elizabeth Dunn, who he quotes. So I'm going to offer you £20.
Yep.
Okay? And you can either spend it on a treat for yourself or spend it on a treat for someone else.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to treat someone else.
Yeah? Who are you going to treat?
I'm going to treat the wife.
What?
I treat you.
Oh, no. I was fishing then. I don't have to fish.
Yeah, I'm going
to
treat us to some more merch.
Yeah, good. So you're going to treat me. Okay, well, apparently, when she actually did this experiment, she didn't say it was about happiness or something, but she gave them all £20 and gave them that choice. Then the people who spent on someone else reportedly felt happier.
Yeah.
And they gave high levels of subjective happiness.
I think that maybe goes back again... another time about Paul Dunne's work, when he describes happiness as most people see it as being about pleasure, and he sees it as pleasure and purpose.
Yeah, and I like that.
And then maybe if you're buying something for someone else, you've got a purpose of trying to maybe
possibly
make them happier. I think that with like teaching,
yeah,
I suppose with the clergy, this is what I thought when I saw those kind of jobs. I was thinking there's a real
purpose
element to it, and we kind of love it because we know that it is quite amusing. I mean, you know, as a job, but also you're making a difference.
Yes.
And like one of the things I saw that I said unhappy in their kind of work was like advertising. You just think, is that sometimes you're pushing something that maybe you feel
people don't want.
Yeah, you know, like the devil's work. If you're in advertising, I don't obviously. believe that really.
Okay, so what are we taking away from that? So we're taking away firstly that, you know, perhaps on a governmental level, should we be pursuing solely GDP? And I think we do at the moment, and perhaps we shouldn't, despite David Cameron back in the day, pre-Trotters. You know, nothing seems to have moved on that particularly. And what else are we taking away?
Well,
maybe they said jobs. If we want to be happy, I always say this to kids at school, actually. You know, when they're leaving 18, I said, you know, choosing the two choices, you know, make sure you choose well in terms of your life partner, but choose your job well. You spend a lot of time there.
Yeah.
And maybe you need to combine a job which you need to find a job that involves some purpose that you're comfortable with.
And get out sometimes. We can be isolated in an office, can't we? Just go for a walk, get out, see nature, talk to people.
Talk to people you've not talked to before.
Yeah, I think that's important. I just want to say just quickly, the NEF, which is the New Economics Foundation, they came out with their Happy Planet Index.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, as a kind of an alternative way, which basically includes well-being, life expectancy, inequality of outcomes, and then they divide it by the ecological footprint.
Wow.
Okay, as a way.
And that's a website, isn't it? Or you can look up that.
Well, the happyplanetindex.org.
Yeah.
You can see that. And the New Economics Foundation is a, you know, an interesting organisation that's kind of very positive in the matter. Who's top of the HPI, Pete?
Happy Planet Index. I'm going to say Bhutan, but it probably isn't.
No.
Yeah.
I think it's Costa Rica.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So there you go. Have quite a small ecological footprint or something.
Good.
Yes. Anyway, right, moving on. What books would you recommend if people wanted to learn more about the economics of happiness?
Okay, so you've mentioned several times Happiness by Design by Paul Dolan. Some of the books I'd want to recommend, they're not strictly speaking about the economics of happiness, but you remember at the start of this episode, we talked about how the law of diminishing sort of marginal utility, and there's always been a tendency in economics to try and quantify things. And in lots of conventional economics, they make assumptions about human nature, and it's that people are rational, they try and maximise, they want more stuff. And there's a couple of books I recommend which just look at things completely differently. What if we made different assumptions about human nature and what people want? Because people probably do want those things, but they probably want other things as well, like positive relationships with people, and so on, sense of purpose. So it's not just about having more stuff. And so a couple of books I'd recommend, quite an oldie first of all, and it is a bit dated this, but there's a book by E.F. Schumacher,
yep,
called Small is Beautiful, which, and there in the subtitle of the book is a study, I think it's called A Study of Economics as If People Matter.
Yes.
And I think even the subtitle, you think, oh yeah, we kind of just talk about maximizing GDP and we forget what that actually means. Mm. You know, we're trying to improve people's lives, but that doesn't mean just material sort of stuff. There's a chapter in that book which is actually an essay which you can also find online quite easily, called Buddhist Economics. And I'm not saying that I'm a Buddhist or people should be Buddhist, but it's just quite interesting if you take different assumptions about what life should be about, where your economy might head. So in other words, if you don't assume that people maximise, if you assume that people should have a job with purpose, I think what Buddhists call a right livelihood.
Right.
You know, that's what sort of, it's one of the, I think, the seven sort of principles of Buddhism is that you should try and pursue right livelihood,
yeah,
like work which is purposeful and virtuous, if you like. But let's say you take a different set of assumptions, where would your economy end up?
Mm.
And sort of that chapter, Buddhist Economics, it's almost a thought experiment to a certain extent, and it's an interesting book. He's talking about Burma. I don't think it ends that well. But I think when he was writing, there was sort of hope that Burma might turn out to be something. Perhaps other one. The other one I'm going to recommend, I think we've mentioned before, is Kate Raworth's Don't Want Economics.
Brilliant book.
Which is a relatively recent book, which I'd strongly recommend, which again looks at, let's replace, or what would happen if we replace GDP with a broader set of objectives and try to live within you know, the natural confines of our planet, maybe pursue other things that might make us happy rather than just economic growth. So I'd strongly recommend that. You know, if we have different goals other than GDP, what does our economic system end up looking like?
Mm. Yeah, good recommendations. I'd probably recommend as well the writings of Oliver Berkman.
Right, okay.
He does a lot of stuff on wellbeing, and he's always interesting to read, has a kind of unique take on things. Just to say, Paul Dolan has a new book out called Happily Ever After. I thought I'd just say that, which is, again, thinking about the narratives that we tell that are supposedly linked to happiness, but maybe are not when you look at the data.
Okay.
So they say laughter is the best medicine. Are there any good economics jokes?
No, I don't have any, so I'm relying on you here.
Well, I've got two.
Okay, go on then.
Okay, but
can I just say at this point,
yeah,
we do now have some Economics in 10 mugs.
Right.
And one of the things we are offering to our loyal listeners, if you send us a joke, economics related, that we really like.
Or anything, a fact.
I want a joke.
Oh, okay.
we will send you a mug.
Yeah, well, yeah, let's not commit too much, because I've got two from listeners.
What, already?
Yeah. So they're
not getting mugs.
Well, no, it depends.
Well, they might get more.
If you really like them, if you really like them. But I do want to say that there is one, I don't know if you know this, maybe, have you ever heard of Yoram Bauman? He's the only stand-up economist.
I have not heard of him.
No. So he actually tours around. He actually does kind of graphic comic books. Did you come and see him, Ruby?
Yeah, we went to see him together, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, with some students.
Yeah.
And it was quite interesting. He was like 10, he got this brilliant little thing about 10 rules or 12 rules of micro macroeconomics. So Joran Brown, check him out. Stand up economist.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've put two on Instagram that were very poor jokes, I think, related to Marx and Keynes. But here we go. Here are two from our listeners, or our followers. We've got one from Jay Bavetta. See what you think of this.
Yeah.
In the last 30 years, economists have predicted 6 of the last 2 recessions.
Okay. I've got to say, it's kind of it's witty, but... Okay, I don't think it's that funny. Well, thank you. Thanks for contributing.
Thanks for contributing. Yeah. And this is from Yusuf.
It's enlightening.
Well, funnily enough, he said about enlightening.
Yeah.
Because this one's about light bulbs.
Right.
So how many laissez-faire economists does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't know.
None. If it really needed changing, market forces would have done it already.
That's all right.
Well, there's
that's our competition so far, I think.
Two. Yeah. So, but we'd love to hear more.
Yeah. And they could get a mug.
Yeah. I got my year 10 economist a few years, no, not a few years, a few months back to write some economics jokes at the end of a lesson. I was flagging for time. And one quite liked it. Said, what about why is Superman so good at his job?
Yeah.
And they went, because he's got. He's specialised.
Oh, like specialised.
Specialised. Yeah. And then you hear some jokes as well about, I was going to tell you a joke, but there's no demand for it. You know, things like that. Yeah, but I'm sure there must be puns out there on certain things. I'm sure you can have a look around and see stuff related
send
to
us,
that.
Send them in. Send them in yeah, via send them Twitter in. Or send them on Instagram.
Instagram, we'd love to see them.
Yeah, good.
What
is that? What are our handles? Just remind people.
Well, just at economics and 10.
Yeah. 10 TEN, isn't it?
Not yeah,
number.
That's
yeah.
very important. Now, I just want, even though this isn't part of the unit, I just want to talk about music a little bit.
Ooh.
Do you mind if
I
go off on this
talk,
tangent? There was a study done by neuroscientist Jacob Jolledge. I think it was from the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And he was saying, basically, what are the songs that make us happiest?
Yeah. Okay.
What do you think was the number one song?
What makes me happiest? I'm thinking of ones I sing in the car with my daughter particularly.
If you get this, I'll be really impressed.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, no. Oh. It is a Queen tune.
Don't Stop Me Now.
Classic. Yes.
Is that it?
Don't Stop Me Now was described by the neuroscientist Jacob Dodge as the happiest song ever. Apparently, it's always slightly faster beat than the norm. Second was Dancing Queen. Third was Good Vibrations. Fourth, Eye of the Tiger. Now, interestingly enough, I asked Professor Catherine Loveday, who's a neuroscientist at the University of Westminster, whether there was any kind of data regards to the UK. And they said that there was some research done. I think it was by Heart or Magic or something like that. And Happy by Pharrell Williams was voted as the kind of number one song.
Yeah.
And Professor Loveday was basically saying that science suggests that there are harmonic changes and melodic sequences that produce emotion. Okay. And in Happy, each group of two lines in the chorus features a falling progression of harmony that basically resolve on a bright major chord.
It's kind of killing it.
Yeah, which no, which creates happiness. And you think about that. I don't know if you know, happy, na, 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 and that bit where it's going down, happy, happy, that bit. Yeah, it's quite interesting. And I don't know, if, again, your knowledge on this, apparently the blue note is a particularly effective when provoking emotions.
Right.
Now, do you know what a blue note is?
No.
Is no. It? See, I thought this was fascinating because on jazz records, there's the blue notes label, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it suddenly made me think, blue notes. Oh, yeah. Interesting. I didn't even know about blue notes. A blue note is a minor interval
where a major would be expected.
Right.
And it's used in jazz and blues to give extra oomph to a song. And apparently Happy has lots of that.
Okay.
But I thought, blue note, I'd never heard of it before. Yeah. But obviously...
There we are.
I thought that'd be interesting. Anyway, we're done there, even though it's a little bit of extra. By producing this podcast, we must have surely created some positive externalities. But what does that mean to the non-economist, Pete?
Okay. Well, to explain positive externalities, I'm going to explain what happens in a normal transaction. So let's say I buy... what shall I buy off you? I will buy a gong bell off you.
Yep.
So what we've been using throughout the episode, which obviously gives you considerable pleasure.
Oh, it does.
So I buy it from you. I think I'm the first party and you're the second party. Okay. Let's say a third person was in the room, not party to that original transaction, but they gain immense pleasure from hearing it. Then we would call them the third party.
Yep.
And we would have created for them a positive externality. They're not involved in the initial transaction, but we're improving their welfare.
Okay.
So other examples, you know, some people talk about bakers, you know, nice bread smell as you walk past. That's a positive externality.
Yeah.
Less trivially, let's say you get educated. Obviously you benefit from that, but then society benefits as well. You're going to be more properly socialized and you might be more productive in a business that you work for in the future. So education seen as having positive externalities.
Well, and hopefully here we're creating cultural capital.
Hopefully we are.
Yeah.
Vaccinations as well. That's another one.
Vaccinations. Does that make you happy?
Well, it doesn't make you happy. It gives you well-being, doesn't it? Because you don't get some horrible disease.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
But also other people benefit because if you're inoculated against disease, they're less likely to catch it from you. So there's a kind of herd immunity.
Yeah, and we should say at this moment in time, measles epidemic on the up.
Yeah, and that's because we had that...
anti-vax stuff.
Yeah, that moronic sort of anti-vax stuff. Crazy. And I know Economics in 10 doesn't like to get involved in controversy, but the anti-vax stuff was moronic.
Yeah.
So there we are. So remember, get your kids vaccinated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's their well-being. They won't get horrible diseases.
That's the takeaway.
And with other people.
There. And I think smiling just generally can be another positive externality. So there you go.
Okay.
Yeah, are we happy with that?
We're happy.
Yeah, brilliant. And there's the bell that I've just sold to you. Okay. that gave someone joy in this room. Or maybe out there.
Yeah.
We've got Poetry Corner now.
Right.
Now, I've written some poems, but I just want to... Can I read another poem?
You can read another poem.
Now, I don't know if you've heard of this, but in terms of some people think that to improve your well-being, it's quite good to kind of focus on, at the end of the day, write a diary.
I do that myself on some occasions. There's a good app called the 5-Minute Journal, which just encourages, it gives you a structure to do that.
Oh, there you go. And that kind of just reminds me how...
Yeah, things you're grateful for.
Good your life is, yeah. And I was reading this book, which is called A Poem for Every Night of the Year. And there was a poem in there. I thought, my word. It's by Jan Dean.
Mm. Okay.
At day's end, I remember 3 good things. Apples, maybe. Their skin shine, smell and soft froth of juice. Water, maybe. The pond in the park, dark and full of secret fish. A mountain, maybe, that I saw in a film or climbed last holiday. And suddenly today it thundered up into a playground game. Or else an owl. I heard an owl today and I made bread. My head is full of all these things. It's hard to choose just 3. I let remembering fill me up with all good things, so that good things will overflow into my sleeping self. And in the morning, good things will be waiting when I wake.
That's very nice.
It's lovely, isn't it? Yeah.
Thank you for that, Gavin.
Well, I'm now going to bring the tone down a little bit. Because, obviously, I thought, well, happiness. And I thought, look, what are supposedly the funny poems?
Yeah. Limericks.
Limericks. Okay, so I've written 3 limericks.
3. Come on, go for it then.
Okay, here we go. There once was a man named Pete who found joy in his dancing feet. He could dance all night long to his favourite songs as he'd eaten his 3 shredded wheat.
Very good.
I mean, when I wrote that, I did think that maybe a younger demographic might not understand the reference to 3 shredded wheat. Because you don't see that advert anymore, do you?
No, you don't. Yeah. Well, I'll know what shredded wheat are.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. This is... linked to our silent partner, okay? Right. But he's not like this, by the way.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Nick.
There once was a Sado called Nick, who loved his new magic trick. He pulled a rabbit from a hat, cut it up, just like that, and it made all his audience sick.
No, just Nick is not like that.
No, he's not. But right. Yeah, anyway.
I really enjoy the reference.
Yeah, okay. And I've ended on this one, and I have to admit, my colleague did say that I probably shouldn't end it on this one, because it's base humour.
Oh, go on.
Okay. There once was a man named Gav
who
ate the spiciest food he could have.
Oh, no.
He loved the hot chilli, but knew it was silly, as he'd spend the next 2 days on the lav.
Toilet humour.
Yeah.
Very British. Right.
So there you go. So that's...
I think we're almost at an end, aren't we?
Yeah.
Right, quickly. Three things that make you happy.
Well, being creative.
Yeah.
I love doing that. Spending time with friends, like you, Pete. You know, this is why we love doing this podcast. That gives us joy. And I suppose, I mean, the reason I love being a teacher is because I get to spend my time with kind of passionate young people.
Yeah.
You know, and the great thing about school is there is something always in there that makes you laugh.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah.
So there are three things.
Good.
What about you?
Family. You know, wife, daughter.
I was going to obviously...
Broader family.
Say that stuff as well.
I'm going to say it for you. So you don't get in trouble. Right. Running.
Yeah.
Actually, exercise does make me happy.
Yeah, exercise, yeah.
We've got some science behind that.
Purpose and pleasure.
Yeah. And mindfulness. I do meditate, and that does contribute to my happiness.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
I can only have three, can't I? I was going to say I love food.
Yeah. But not too much, remember.
Not too much, yeah.
Because then you get
not
diminishing returns.
So I think that is bringing us to an end. So thank yous.
Yeah, we'd like to thank you all for listening and hope that you will listen to our next podcast. We'd also like to thank our friend Nick, who gave us technical advice with regards to podcasting. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter at Economics in 10, where you can read the poem at your leisure, and on Instagram, where you can see exclusive artwork and behind-the-scenes footage.
And remember, if you can send us a joke, a fact you think we might find fascinating, or, and this is a good one, a picture of yourself in another country which proves in some way that you're listening to our podcast, then we will send you a mug.
What, another country?
Tell mug. Depend on the postage. No, we'll do our best.
We'll do our best. Okay. Have a lovely day.
Yeah, thanks, everyone, and be happy.
Yay!